And you remember all of the receivers that are available on the market. This one is 2.87 inches by 1.2 inches by 0.47 inches has built-in antenna, so a receiving frequency band, HFS, WM, W, VHF, and W will be the short wave, long waves. The battery is 800 milliamps, and the casing is ugly. The casing is absolutely ugly. The ABS that they use, ABS could be very good material for it, so it does have a, hold on. It says very lightweight, very low power consumption, good sensitivity, sensitivity compatible with PL330, okay, another model. The radio stations of RDS on FM band, DSP bandwidth, signal meter, VFO settings stored to the memory. And your long wave covers from 9 kilohertz to whatever the end of it would is almost 2 megahertz, right, before the short wave starts. I'm not sure where, what is the end of the long wave. Back to you.
I don't know. I usually just leave it on a table and then just kind of look it up every time I need to, because I don't really allude to it too much. It sounds sort of like an RTL dongle clone. Okay, it uses a little bit different silicon, and it uses that ESP32. We talked about the ESP32 a couple of weeks ago when you were talking about microwave presence detections.
Okay, so the calls for it. 1 kHz muting while tuning, impossible enter direct frequency, low output audio on 3.5 millimeter socket, the tiny speaker, and slow to use. And some other things, no FM mode on shortwave, like let's say you want to have FM on TV band, you cannot have it. Low display brightness. Actually, the brightness is usually given in nits. So let's say in the film industry, if you have something that is below 1500 nits, you cannot use it outside. And something that is over 1500, usually 2500 nits, it is good for direct sunlight. If you have a screen on your computer, or laptop, or any other screen that you want to watch or watch what's going on in the film scene.
The latest OLEDs out of Consumer Electronics Show, apparently someone had a sample to measure. They measured 4,000 nits out of that screen.
Oh boy, 4,000 nits. I have, I'm trying to have something that is one brand and a good one, which is Blackmagic. So I have a special monitor for Blackmagic, and this one is 2,500 nits. But you think 4,000 nits? Absolutely crazy. How much that cost?
It was just a demo screen, so I don't think they've determined the price yet. But it's going to be very expensive, and probably going to give everyone's eyeballs a suntan.
Okay, so for my monitor from Blackmagic, I'm not sure what's the model number, editor monitor. It's a 12-inch if I remember correctly. That one was sold for $1,455. Right now is about $990, something like that, because Blackmagic has tendency to set up price high and then sometime later to make it lower, but then the new product is coming with the price of previously the one that was hard to sell.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a different market than the TV monitors that were being shown at consumer electronics shows. You know, there's high-end, ridiculously large screens, and then there are just gadgets. There are TVs that fold and roll and do all kinds of things that look cool until you ask yourself, what the hell do you need it for? LG, I think, was promoting transparent TV monitors. I'm not quite sure what you do with a transparent TV monitor.
I believe mounted to the window. So let's say you could turn the window into the TV. Back to you.
I don't know. I think that's kind of gilding the lily. The way that they presented it was just, you know, you could see through it to the other part of the rooms, and then you can put things up and just amaze your friends or enemies, whatever. To, you know, because those things kind of cost about $30,000 to $70,000. So again, I'm not quite sure what the price point is for, except to say that you had one. I mean, there was one transparent model that they showed that had a blackout screen in the back. So you could press the magic button, and there would be a background screen that was black that made it look like a regular color television set, and only for $70,000.
Some people have too much money. And some others think that those people who have too much money are willing to spend it. They could be wrong, but to you?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that's what's going on. A lot of things that used to annoy me that I've grown used to at this point with Consumer Electronics Show is more of just a show-off, you know, who has the biggest one. Especially screens. So, you know, every year it's sort of the same thing. You know, this year it's 162-inch diagonal. Next year it'll be 185-inch diagonal. Year after that it'll be 200. At one point or another, you're not going to be able to fit it into any kind of architectural object. You know, it'll just be so massive. You know, basically, they'll be offering to sell you the damn Las Vegas Sphere. So it's just showing off technology a lot of times. So most of that stuff, I doubt, ends up really being in some wealthy guy's apartment. It ends up being in a demo until they get tired of it or have something even more absurd to show off as a demo.
Absolutely agree, Dr. Ray. What Planewave and Bohr model of Aton have in common as tool in education? So we have a Bohr model of an atom, and it's being still used in a school. So this is the kind of discussion that we have, is of Planewave and a Bohr model of an atom. We had with Dr. Roy, and he gave a few comments that I love. Actually, that was the one that I love very much. Why do we use something that is a dinosaur and is not even complete and is not even good? Why do we use still in schools? So we're talking about every high school in United States, and then we're talking some of the higher education introductory courses where this model is being taught. But there is a catch in it, and the catch is here, chemistry. Dr. Roy, please.
I'm not quite sure if there was a question anywhere there. There's a lot of things that are taught in introductory science that are or were complete nonsense or close to complete nonsense. When I was going to high school, in biology, they showed, I'm sure a lot of people remember high school biology, they showed these beautiful drawings of a fetus developing slowly, and the idea was that as a given fetus develops, they kind of go through the stages of being more primitive life forms, and they pseudo-evolve in utero to be mammals, right? Those were infamous drawings. They're based on a guy who fudged his results and ruined his career. And yet those illustrations went on for centuries. I don't think they use them anymore, but in high school I remember seeing them. And they were just make-believe. The guy drew them because you couldn't photograph them because they weren't accurate as a photograph. But, you know, it was back in the 1800s when it was very difficult to do photographs anyway. So there's a lot of things. And the Bohr atom annoys the heck out of me. Even Dick May, rest in peace, kind of got the wrong idea about electrons. He kind of thought of them as planetary systems, all as astronomical mechanics, that the nucleus was the sun. The electrons were the planets, and they rotated around the sun or the nucleus, and they spun internally like planets spin around. And that's not what quantum mechanics is, unfortunately. And so people got an incredibly wrong idea of electrons being dimensional objects that spin. The spin in quantum mechanics is a quantum phenomenon. It's not mechanical. And if an electron actually physically spun, it would violate a bunch of physical laws. So I think it's simplification to the point of a fairy tale. And, you know, I understand the concept of simplifying things because a lot of times life is very complicated and most people don't have the time or the patience to wrap their brains around something. So I understand that, but it comes a point that you've simplified it to the point where it's just a fairy tale. It's fantasy. And the Bohr atom is fantasy.
From a historical standpoint, we had, so let's say talking about hydrogen atom, so proposed by Bohr, proposed by the Bohrji and Schrodinger. So in the Bohr model, electrons are point particles that move around the nucleus in circular orbits, and at fixed radius, right? Okay, I'm lucky. In the Bohrji, the model of electron is a standing wave or wings with the same radii, and in the Bohr model, the same as the Bohr model, but the Schrodinger model that is actually giving the light to the physics and education, a cloud of probability where the density is given by the solution to the tri-dimensional Schrodinger equation for the column potential that the electron feels from the nucleus. But if you were pointed to something positive, you were giving as a sermon, you were giving the to be not criticized, but to be somehow presented in positive light. What word would you expect to use?
I would fail at attempting to do that. It's sort of like people who good-naturedly, and I hope I don't ruin anything for people, but that Santa Claus isn't real. I understand that, you know, maybe the Bohr atom is meant for 8-year-olds as well. I don't know. There's a lot of little things in science that annoys the heck out of me because it was arbitrary and they had a 50-50 chance of getting it practically right and they got it wrong, but they kind of locked in on it. You know, the whole concept that current goes in the opposite direction of the flow of electrons. That's simply because they flipped a coin and they guessed wrong. So, I mean, we're stuck with the idea that current is the opposite direction of electron flow. Because ions don't flow through wires. So, I mean, why is the current direction the way it is? Because, again, someone made a guess and they were wrong. So there's a lot of little details in science. As I've always kind of said, science is actually quite messy. When you go to school, you're kind of taught on a very introductory level that it's very clean and sterile, and it went from A to B to C to D to E, and there were no bumps in the road. You know, we were looking for something that electromagnetic waves flow through. So we had the ether. There is no such thing as ether. People were confused about how fires work, and they created a theoretical antioxidant called phlogiston. And they spent many years trying to capture some phlogiston to prove their theories that were all wrong. So, I mean, science is messy, but science is beautiful, and it's self-correcting for the most part. So I hope that ultimately the Bohr atom gets retired someplace, you know, maybe kindergarten.
Hey, this is the Pip.
Yes?
I had a friend at Cornell during his PhD tried to sneak a phlogiston 77 spin 1/2 NMR spectrum into his dissertation. Didn't quite work.
Well, I probably would have liked to meet him. I kind of like the dead ends, as long as they remain dead. It's the dead ends that keep coming back at you that annoy the heck out of me.
He was a character. He's retired now, but he did some great work in solid-state chemistry. Anyway, just listening tonight, enjoying the net, as always, back to net.
Okay, very good. Well, back to you, Wesley, but, you know, one of these days you should do a story on phlogiston.
Well, actually, I wanted to say a few words about the material that I have sent you, scientific one, from the Department of Physics, University of Colorado. And there is the Department of Physics, University of British Columbia, Vancouver, and whatsoever. And this one, it says, why we should teach Bohr model and how to teach it effectively. And there is a humongous amount of work that was done by teachers and scientists to the study that was provided to show whether it is worth, whether it is not, what is the impact on the students, does it help or not, and let's jump. And to XCN. And the some common words that were found, especially in terms of chemistry, but the Bohr is... The Bohr proposed that energy levels of the electron is handy for... No. So, I mean, maybe different words. So it's handy for chemistry and for some physics classes, and classical physics is still taught in schools, even though that is not accurate. I'm looking at those words because I'm reading the line from the article. Okay. Back to you, Dr. Rush.
Okay, I mean, we talked about this before, and Newtonian physics came before quantum mechanics and relativity, and simplification of quantum mechanical concepts and relativity will end up being Newtonian physics. So, you know, for simple cases, Newtonian physics will give you a close answer. It will not give you the accurate answer, but it will be off by so little that fundamentally there's no real difference and no reason to do to solve quantum mechanical electrodynamic equations when you could just use Maxwell's equations and get an answer that's correct to, you know, the 10 hundredths or less or something. So it's simple. You know, why bother people with the complicated answers if you don't really need the accuracies to be that ridiculously tight? And so that's fundamentally why engineers are taught Newtonian physics. It's a lot easier, and it gets the job done. And engineering, part of it is to get the damn job done. You know, if you get the right answer, but it takes you 500 years, then tough, you're not really doing your job. So, I mean, I understand that. That's why Newtonian physics is still taught. It's very often taught initially to physics majors before they get submerged in quantum mechanics and relativity. But a much more accurate way of looking at the universe, unfortunately, is derived from quantum mechanical concepts and relativistic concepts rather than Newtonian. Newtonian makes everyone feel comfy. In Newtonian physics, there is a fundamental reference point, one point that's much more important than any other reference point. In relativity, there is no particular reference point. You pick your own. You want to have a geocentric solar system? Fine. Set the reference point at the Earth, and you have a very complicated, confusing orbit, but you have the Earth at the center of the universe. So Newtonian physics doesn't like that. Newtonian physics thinks that a foot is a foot, and an inch is an inch, and a second is a second, and relativity knows that space-time can be distorted beyond belief. So, you know, I understand why it's useful, but, you know, you can only take it so far. And when you start to teach people things that are just fairy tales, that really, in my humble little opinion, doesn't really get you anywhere but the self-satisfaction of thinking you know something when you know squat. Some people keep the concept of keep it simple, stupid. Well, sometimes you keep it too simple, and then everyone's stupid. So, you know, I mean, that's just one man's opinion.
CAF2CC.
Yes, Brian?
Hello, Roy. Sorry I'm a little late to the party. Actually, a lot late to the party. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm here.
Oh, okay, very good. Do you want me to put your name on the list for later on, or you just wanted me to know you're there?
You can put me on the list. I'll hang out for a little while.
Okay, very good. So, Wes, back to you. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I'm sure educators who have done it for the last 20 years want to do it until they retire. It's just the nature of inertia. I think it's a terrible model, and I think it confuses people who deserve better. You know, I think Dick shouldn't have kind of gone around with the idea that electrons are spinning in place and then rotating around a nucleus much like the sun. That's what he was taught in electrical engineering school, because again, it was Newtonian physics that he was taught. And, you know, the quantum mechanics was, I guess, rather a kind of soft version. Because you don't really need to know esoterica like relativity unless you're doing something like ground position satellite systems where you have to take in the time dilation effect or else your GPS doesn't work right.
Yep, that's it, Ian. I'm thinking about creating some puzzle for the plane wave. Because plane wave, with the time, gives a three-dimensional structure. Used in education. But there is a question, why the z-axis is the axis that is used for calculation and for presentation? not the XY, but the Z axis showing the direction of propagation. But we may leave it for later. The next one is 6, unless you want to say a few words about it. The next one is 6 gigahertz spectrum analyzer, let me drop. Okay, this is the last one, I believe. Okay, so everybody knows it. Oh, that was the song, everybody knows. Beautiful song, actually. And nano VNA is very much popular in ham radio community, but then the spectrum analyzer. He has some problem, but it's not a problem as long as you know it. So there is a spectrum analyzer that I sent you the picture of it in the email, and this one is small. It costs $37.82, and it does have a spectrum analyzer, signal generator, handheld spectrum analyzer, 300 milliamps battery. It has a Wi-Fi, 2G, 4G, LTE, CDMA, GSM, whatever. The only problem with this is that it's from 35 megahertz to 6.2 gigahertz. So if we want to go lower, we cannot do it. But hey, you have $37.82. Instead of just spending it for a coffee and lunch, you can buy something that you may not need. The other one is, that one is in the video for ham radio, and it's pretty handy, I would say. It's $181.80, and this one is Tiny SA Ultra Spectrum Analyzer. You want to comment on it, Victoria?
Okay, it's sort of like the spectrum analyzer version of the nano VNA. It's a nice little toy. It has a wonderful range. It looks kind of a little ticky-tacky. I own one of them, and I went around the house to check out my Wi-Fi emissions and all kinds of interesting things. So, you know, it's certainly worth the money. You know, I mean, if you're interested in how Wi-Fi works, because Wi-Fi is principally 2.4 gigs and 5 gigs, and the latest, the Wi-Fi 7, I think, has a 6 gig channel as well. So it's interesting. You know, every so often, there are people who try to sell you little detectors because they tell you to worry about RF radiation poisoning you. And, yeah, of course, RF is all over the darn place. You know, most of our equipment is Wi-Fi and Bluetooth enabled. So they're all kind of emitting low-level radio waves. So, you know, if you get one of these spectrum analyzers, you can get a better idea of what to be worried about.
Yeah, so the one that I have sent you is 100 kilohertz, 5 to 5.3 gigahertz. USB Type-C with the whole set of everything that you need for it, and even including the small memory, 32 gigabytes, that is sliding into the slot in it. So again, $141.80, this 4-inch LCD display, Tiny Spectrum Analyzer, Ultra 4-inch, I believe that might be something that is bigger, but I didn't see that. Now, for comparison, don't buy, of course, that one for $37.82. I'm trying to avoid crap. I'm not saying that everything is Chinese is crap. I just have a rash on the skin when I hear Chinese made. Of course, they might have something that is good to do, but not for this money. Let me drop. Okay, so for comparison, that SH60STC, which is the Bird 6 GHz spectrum analyzer for $11,000, $10,000, depends, plus $3,800 additional software if you want. You can compare it to $141.
get something like DigiKey, so something that is Chinese but is better. So it's silent? No, it's not Chinese. It's Siglin. Siglin technology is, this is not Chinese. SSA3021X Plus. And this one is not expensive, only $1,300. And this is really good one. But that just looks like a... No, it's a spectrum analyzer with the generator built in. I'm not sure. Dr. Roy, the one that you have, does it have a tracking generator?
I think it does. I haven't kind of played with it in a long time, but I think it also has a signal generator. It's probably a square wave generator, but it has a signal generator.
Okay. Of course, Siglent has SNA5000A vector network analyzer that is from 9 kilohertz to 8.5 kilohertz, and this is excellent stuff. The only thing is you need to have a $42,000 for it.
I'll take it out of petty cash.
And that would be everything for today. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. I do appreciate the chance given to me for presenting that material to the ham radio community. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
I think I fell out of All-Star again. Brian, are you out there? You got any good questions for tonight?
Oh, hi, Roy. Oh, I didn't know what happened to you. It was like silence, you know what I mean? I thought my radio was dead. Let's see. Any good questions? Always questions. Let's see. Did you know... let me ask this question. Let's see. What kind of questions would you like?
I don't know. Interesting ones, I guess.
Okay. Interesting questions. Let's see. All right. Let's see. How far can a human climb a mountain without occurring hypoxia?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, because that's an endurance type of a thing where, you know, people kind of train for years to get to levels that the average guy would never imagine, and other people kind of cheat, you know, they'll get IV red blood, packed red blood cells to increase their oxygen carrying capacity, or take shots that induce erythrogenesis, the overproduction of red blood cells. So, you know, there's a broad spectrum of people who just train and other people who just cheat to be able to survive low oxygen concentrations. And also, there are genetic aspects. Some populations that live for thousands of years in elevation develop a genetic traits that have better oxygen carrying capacity. So, you know, it's ultimately a very complicated thing. It's sort of like, you know, what's the limit this week? And, you know, knowing that, you know, next week someone probably would break the record. It's kind of like, how long can someone hold their breath?
Comment?
Certainly.
Yeah, WA2VDH. I would guess as a first approximation, the distance that an aircraft has to come down before to where they can stop using masks. I think that's around 10,000 feet. I could be wrong, though.
Okay, but that's kind of a given for the average human being. I'm sure that there are a lot, especially natives to those high elevation areas, that could suffer those low pressures without much problem.
AEC, EVA, with comments?
Certainly.
Yeah, Mount Everest has been climbed, I think now, many times with the climbers not using supplemental oxygen. So I think the answer to the question is, how high can a mountain climber climb without oxygen? And the answer is as high as possible on Earth.
Okay, that's a good point. You have to kind of presuppose some kind of artificial construct that's taller than Everest in order to kind of test the limitations.
A comment.
Yes, Brian, I expected you to kind of respond to that one, yeah.
Well, what I find interesting is that people with, let's say, people who have pulmonary diseases that require supplementary oxygen at sea level, if they went to, let's say, Denver, Colorado, which is like a mile above sea level, what they call the Mile High City, do you think that they could possibly adapt to that and then come back and wean themselves off of the oxygen coming back to sea level?
No, because the stressors are kind of identical. So if you have obstructive or restrictive pulmonary disease and you can't exchange oxygen efficiently, the amount of increased blood production that a body might try to counter it with would be insufficient. So, no, you wouldn't develop it. Maybe if you somehow could get a genetic transplant from people who evolved to live and survive healthily in very low-pressure, high-altitude places, that you might give them some respite from their respiratory disorders. But their internal responses to hypoxia are already in place before you stress them. You probably would just kill them, or you'd shorten their life expectancy by putting them under more hypoxic stress.
So if you were to take a person with pulmonary disease of any particular kind and give them packed red blood cells at sea level, how long would that last them before they require supplemental oxygen again, or does it not work that way?
I doubt that you could. It depends upon the degree of the person's hypoxia. You would improve their condition temporarily, but red blood cells have a limited life expectancy, and then you start to develop complications. If you're going to keep transfusing a person with packed red blood cells, you have to deal with the iron load that you're creating. Normal bodies turn over iron. They break down the old red blood cells. They recover the iron, and they use it to build new hemoglobin. In the case of your artificial method, you'd be introducing massive amounts of iron, which we haven't evolved to remove efficiently. So what happens is you get a condition called hemosiderosis, in which you get iron deposits all over the place, and it screws up your organ functions in general. So you might get some minimal benefit temporarily, but if you kept on going to that well, you'd kill the poor person due to some other ailment.
Okay, I just have one follow-up. Let's say you have a person who requires repeated transfusions over a period of months. Will they become ferrotoxic? And if so, how would that be treated?
There are cases where the treatment is polycythemia vera, in which due to a screwing up of the equilibrium of blood production, you kind of overproduce blood, and for those people, they're actually bloodlet. You know, I don't know if they use leeches. I think they just use intravenous lines to remove iron. I guess you could use chelation therapy. That's materials that bind with metals, and you could use that to lessen the chance of iron overload.
Where is the extra iron stored? Is it primarily in the liver, or is it distributed throughout the body in certain particular areas?
Primarily, it's in blood manufacturing centers, the spleen and the bone marrows. There's iron. If you kind of overload those systems with iron, they can be deposited all over the body, very often in the liver. But you know, in other places as well, if you have the concentration high enough. But for most of us, most of our iron stores are located in bone marrow and our spleen.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I read that if you drink green tea, that's supposed to suck the iron out of your system. Or is that just one of those stories that make it to the internet?
Yeah, I think it's one of those stories. I'm unaware of any chelating molecules in tea. It sounds like something that someone's grandmother told the person. They went and they wrote a web site article on the subject.
Okay, very good. I drink a lot of green tea anyway because I like it. I saw that one time. Anyway, very good. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's kind of would be detrimental. There's far more people with iron deficiency anemia, especially women. Menstruating women lose a lot of iron, and if their diet isn't relatively enriched in iron, they can develop iron deficiency anemia. So for every case of polycythemia vera, there's probably 10,000 women with iron deficiency anemia. So I would assume that tea companies wouldn't promote that, because, again, I would assume they'd want to sell it to a lot of menstruating women. Brian, you want to say something?
Just curious, my mother-in-law was in her mid-80s, and she developed anemia without any obvious sign. Upon scans, it was made known that she had lung cancer, never used tobacco at all. And since that time, she was losing hemoglobin and required frequent transplant, frequent transfusions, and never had chelation therapy, and never could hold a hemoglobin level, and it's unknown to me what she actually passed away from, whether it was metastasis or whether it was liver toxicity. Iron toxicity. What would be, like, your guess?
I would assume much more likely cancer. Iron toxicity requires a ridiculous amount of iron load. My surmise was it's not uncommon for malignancies to generate a lot of organic compounds that have catabolic kind of responses and kind of undermines a lot of the mechanics of living. So probably just the material that was spewed out from the metastasized cancer was sufficient to suppress her her blood production. So it was just a matter, wasn't that necessarily that the blood was being destroyed at a rapid rate. It probably was as much that it wasn't being produced at its normal rate. The normal things that kind of initiate increased production of red blood cells assumes a kind of non-cancerous state. So once cancers are kind of doing all kinds of strange things and tapping the energy sources for the body, a lot of systems kind of go into underdrive. So it's again, I would think she would require massive quantities of blood transfusion, which I doubt was given to her. A lot of times when people have chronic anemias, they don't top people off because the idea is that this is going to be an ongoing problem. You can't just kind of get it up to the right levels and assume it's going to stay there. It's going to go down as soon as you stop doing it. So you go from a average level of hemoglobin to the lowest minimum that you think the person can tolerate because it will produce the least complications. So I don't think that she was oversaturated by iron unless she had that iron, she had that anemia for many, many years and her doctors were intensely aggressive about managing it.
Well, she did have surgery for the lung and we thought that might be a cure since she didn't require any chemotherapy. But the point is that she kept losing hemoglobin. Her hematocrit level was very low. And I was just curious that, about what would continue to go ahead and have a low hemoglobin level. And you're saying that, cancer is a possibility that could interfere with red blood cell production. Am I correct?
Yes, there's a bunch of things. When some people, when they get very old, their hemoglobin count just drops and you can't find any kind of cause for it. There's more than a few. Having a low blood count comes from two different things. In the case of, say, occult bleeding from colon cancer, it's just sheer blood loss. It's just these lesions bleed and get excreted. In other cases, it's an actual shutdown of the chain of events that grows red blood cells. It's just the red blood production level decreases, and so it never kind of makes up for the short lifespan of the present red blood cells. So it could either be loss of blood or it could be some factor that's diminishing the rate at which the blood is being replaced.
I see. Okay. So this is beginning to make a little bit more sense to me in understanding it. Are there certain types of cancers that are known to suppress blood cell production?
There are so many different cancers and so many different variations. There's cancers of different organ systems where the original mutated cell, you know, some come from the colon, and some come from the pancreas, and some come from the brain. And there are different lines of cells in each of those. So it's vast to the point where, you know, there's an entire field of medicine called oncology, which they also treat anemias just historically because of things, but they're the cancer experts. And, you know, I'm sure there's some varieties of cancer that present more often in chronic anemias. I don't really remember what they are because the oncologists kind of deal with them. And but, you know, there are so many. That's why, you know, when people kind of compare heart disease with cancers, it's kind of apples and unicorns. Because heart disease is kind of heart disease. You know, there's not that much variation in the theme. Cancer, there are hundreds of varieties of cancers out there, each a little bit different than the next one. So it's a much more complicated problem to solve than cardiac problems, which is why, you know, cardiac disease has been treated much reasonably better over the years in medicine than cancer treatment. Occasionally, someone comes up with something great for one or two specific types of cancers, but there's never probably going to be a magic bullet for cancer, other than maybe some kind of genetic engineering where, you know, someone takes the lesion and then runs it through a super intelligent computer and builds a weapon precisely for that mutagen.
Interesting. So, okay. Well, let's hope that there is a common, common flaw with cancer cells that can be exploited in terms of treatment. That would be an interesting thing. So I just have one more question I'd just like to take to the next level if there's nobody waiting.
I don't think anyone's waiting, Brian.
Yeah, at the end I'm going to have a disposal.
Okay, so I'll ask my next question, which is kind of related to the previous question in a slightly different way, different tangent. Now, we're talking about RF, and RF is so omnipresent all around us. Is it possible that just walking around houses and buildings and being in areas where there's a lot of RF could increase or predispose you to acquiring cancer?
Generally speaking, no. We've mentioned it before that radio waves are non-ionizing radiation. They do not split molecular bonds. They do not excite electrons enough to have the electrons move to a different level and break the chemical bonds. Whereas, X-rays and gamma rays of a certain power can do that. They can burrow into your cells. They can attack the DNA directly, break the bonds, change the sequence of genetic coding, and eventually produce some precancerous mutations, which, you know, cancer tends to be a kind of lack of autoregulation. Our cells have a predisposition to equilibrium. They kind of know if they're sitting next to something, and if you remove the cell next to them, they sort of know to reproduce and fill that space, but then they stop. Cancer generally tends to be that the cells lose the ability to do that. They reproduce and they take up the space, and then they continue to reproduce, and then they seed all over the place, and you've lost any kind of cellular control. So Yeah. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, I think it does. But where do microwaves, now, without me looking at a reference chart, I would have to do that, to be quite honest with you. Where do microwaves fall out on the RF spectrum? Is it above visible light, or is it below?
It's way below. It's 2.4 gigahertz. It's the same same frequency as your Bluetooth devices and your Wi-Fi devices. Matter of fact, some of your Wi-Fi devices, if you have recent ones, operate at 5 gigs and occasionally at 6 gigs. So, it's way down there. It's in microwaves, but it's kind of the low end of microwaves.
So are we speaking about, let's say, for a router, for example, a Bluetooth, are we talking milliwatts versus several hundred watts concentrated?
Well, it sort of depends what you're kind of talking about. Are you talking about the transmitter? The transmitter probably more than milliwatts. The effect of field density is probably in the units of milliwatts. But the field density away from a microwave is also probably in milliwatts, because you have a Faraday cage containing most of the transmissions. But that's the whole point of microwaves. Microwaves don't ionize anything. Microwaves just heat up the water molecules in your food, so that it's hot instead of cold, So that's the whole purpose of cooking with microwaves and such. But it's a lot more power, but it's shielded power. So, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Understood. So if you put a, if you were using Bluetooth device, like earbuds, for example, or headphones that are Bluetooth, constant exposure to that can't predispose you to damage, can it?
Again, no. Very low power, and 2.4 gigahertz can only warm things up. So, will it increase the warmth of your outer ear canal by a hundredth of a degree? Maybe, probably not. But that's ultimately all that it does. Waste 2.4 gigahertz RF only produces waste heat. And, walking into sunlight produces a lot more waste heat, probably.
Okay. Well, very good, Roy. Thank you very much for the good explanation. I appreciate that. I will now yield to anyone else's question.
Yeah, I have a question. AG2RY about cancer.
Okay, David, what about cancer?
Well, my sisters, when they got married, they each bought a house. My mother went to the town registry, the records, to check to see if, these particular locations were free of any kind of toxicity, like toxic waste dumping, etc. She was able to acquire this information. Do you think that in terms of cancer and the possibilities of getting cancer, could they be about something that is outside of the body, like the possibility of toxicity underneath the house?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of mutagenic cancer-causing agents that, if you live next to them, they might vaporize, and you might inhale them, or they might get into the well, and you might drink them, or other ways. So it's never really a great idea to kind of live in a place that used to be a chemical dump, because a lot of things we sort of took for granted. I know I certainly did. I was a chemistry major. I used the solvent benzene a lot And benzene is a very good organic solvent, but it's also, you know, a liver toxic material. And, I mean, we also used to, you know, drill holes through asbestos mats to put our tubes in to kind of heat things and, you know, breathe in deeply the asbestos fibers that were flying around. So there's a lot of toxic, dangerous materials. For a time, people were selling each other uranium coated dinner plates. They were irradiated. They put radiation sources